This is channel 2 right. This is channel 2 right. And it's the very end of my rounds on Thursday the 3rd of October 1968. And Mr. Gilbert is telling about farming with Miss Patterson. And how he got that place down there. And then what he did in those years after 1949. And this is channel 2 right. The very end of the tape that is on all of channel 1 over. It's overflow from channel 1 over.
I think two or three others over on Wardale. Over.
No,
I finally seen it and I decided, well, I guess this was it.
Well, now, how much property went with this?
This thing here?
Yeah.
It's 16 acres. But deed says 18 acres, but then when he got it, it was 16 acres. I don't know where they lost it. 2 acres out. I think when they put this Evanston Road, hard road through there, they're taking part of it. Then this was the main highway here. And then when they changed the highway down there, they're taking a corner off of it again, see?
Mm-hmm.
So, then somehow or another, it got out to 16 acres. And then they took another 0.6 acre when they four laned it.
Yeah.
So that left me 15 acres and 0.4, I think, what it calls for now.
Yeah. Well, now, when you come, this field had been cultivated.
No, it was growed up, but it was cleaned off pretty well. The people that bought it, that I bought it off of, they had Jesse Walker's, what is that Walker boy? Oh, Jesse's oldest son, he lives up there yet. He was a...
Frank Walker.
Yeah, I know him.
He was working around here with Patterson's, and the people that bought this was friends of Patterson's. See, and had Frank out here. He cleaned it up. That was all grown up. And he cleaned up a bunch around here, and it got where you could get in there to cultivate. See.
Mm-hmm.
So then I done a lot of cleaning up here around the back and down through there, and enlarged the field.
Yeah. Well, how did you happen to be farming with Miss Patterson?
Well, I come out here and farmed a year by myself, and Miss Patterson wanted me to take the tractor and go in with her and farm. So I did. A couple of years later, we went broke. So we was in Farger's 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
She was a furnished tractor and the land. We never farmed ours here. After I went in with her, we farmed all of her. She had all that cross road over there, see? All down and back. We had some of this out here at Stanley's in the back. And
then you had...
We had farmed that...
Over there at Liza's.
We farmed that... bottom over there, Jesse Walker's.
Yeah.
We had beans and corn over there. And we raised a lot of stuff. We didn't get nothing for it. So so finally, we broke up and I went back to the ice plant up there. I worked at the ice plant when I was a little kid. Up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, same people. I went up there and worked with them. While I went to the university, well, I first went to the university before I went to them, and I was working up down at Murphy Hall, maintenance man. And I getting along all right, but the guy that was directly over me, he wasn't there, he was on vacation. When he come in, well, he was sore because they hired me and put me on there while he was away, and me and him didn't get along at all, so I just quit. I went over to the ice plant, got a job, and went to work.
Was Phil working up there then?
No, he went to work there. He went to work up there while I was there. I come out and notified him to come in that they wanted to go up there, so he did. So I come out and I went worked the ice plant there about a year or two. Finally, I decided I'd carpenter again.
Oh, you've carpentered. That's so, how you happened to do all this. Yeah.
So I went back to the university when it was had that one of them buildings, the old buildings. They tore all the inside. All it left is the roof and the walls. And we tore it all out and rebuilt it in that reinforced steel, you know, and concrete floors and all that. Well, I worked there quite a while. And, I don't know. I worked all over the university. I worked in the Florida Union, the old Florida Union building, put an extra floor on top of that. Then there was a put an extra floor on the another building over there. And we started on that storage outfit there where they keep the lumber and all now. I started on that. We put in the forums there and all. And I worked there a couple of years, I guess. Then we got laid off. They run short of money or something. We got laid off. Then I went back to the ice plant and I stayed there quite a while. Then they sent for me to the university when they was putting them shingles in all them houses over there where the married people lived. Mm-hmm. And I worked there till they run out of money again. We got laid off. I went back to the ice plant. Finally, I laying around here, and Mr. Stanley, he said to Mr. What you call it, was out to the Agriculture Department out of the Extension Service. He wanted me to come out there, so I went out there and I worked there for about a year and a half, two years, I guess, a little over 2 years,
yeah,
I guess.
A little over 2 years.
Good Lord. And, you ready to work around here.
Carpenter gang out there.
Yeah.
We got a lot of stuff out there.
Not changing the subject, I heard something about the school business down there this morning. The reason the school is for sale, Herlong owns that property.
Oh.
And years ago, they gave it to the school to be used for a school as long as the school was to be used, you know.
Yeah.
It was just donated or leased or something, I don't know what. But anyway, the Herlongs now are going to take the property back. So they have to get rid of the building, so the building is for sale. That's how come the building is for sale. No property with it.
So they have to wreck it then.
Whoever buys it, unless they can deal with Herlong to buy the property, but from the way they talked up there this morning, that Herlong is going to reclaim the land because it was just
given to the county. Well, a lot of land is donated that way with a clause in there. It donated to the school as long as it was to use as a school. When it ceased to be used as a school, it's reversed back.
There's some people down there looking at it. They said that it would make a wonderful place to turn that into four apartments, see? But they haven't been able to get the land. So you got to have the land. You can't go and buy it and put an apartment house in there if the people are not going to let you have land.
No.
That'd be foolish. So that's why they haven't get rid of it. So it's got to be sold.
You registered, of course.
Ever voted. Ever.
Is that right?
I don't know.
Oh, shoot. I wish I didn't have to be in the work gang.
I don't know about that. I know that's the way it was with the baby. I mean,
Rudolph, it's still smoking a little there. Well, it'd be nice if you could. If you do, you have to dig a hole there.
Well, it's all right. I got some brush down there. I'm going to pull up here, I think, chop it up, put it around this, see if I can burn it up.
Yeah. Solid.
Yeah, it's pretty solid.
Gosh. Well, you see what it's holding it up. Solid as that is. It's just a rim, but it's solid.
Yeah.
Hmm.
got any oranges down around your house this year?
No.
Grapefruit?
No.
I got a few oranges.
All froze out.
This time. I got a few grapefruit. They got nothing like a crop, but we got quite a few oranges scattered around.
Me and Miss Patrick, we raised a lot of beans. They made out pretty good on the beans. And we raised a lot of squash out there. We made a little money on the squash. But Miss Patterson, she's one of these kind, you know, she wants to keep picking. See, well, we got about 1,600 hampers on the road that we never got a penny out of, see?
Oh. And you were shipping them?
Yeah.
Of course you did.
We never got a penny out of them.
Yes, sir.
They even done us one time for shipping charges on them. I said, just forget it.
The old guava bush had a half dozen guavas on it this year. It got through the winter pretty good last year. Well, look at that.
If it gets through this winter, we ought to have a lot of guavas next year.
I wonder if there's any way of protecting them a little, Jim. Could you put up a wall or shield or something?
I'm going to see if I can't put up a plastic around them or something. This one is protect them a little. They don't stand too much cold weather.
Yeah. Well, how would you go about it?
Well, you can put your frame up there and just tag it to it. They claim it. I've seen a lot of people, you know, pull them up there and tie them up and put claws around them and tie them up, but they claim that don't do so good in a way. But because where the cloth touches, you know, they'll freeze. But I don't know if you had thick enough cloth, I don't guess it would.
I don't know. I never thought about that.
But I think you get that plastic and make your frame, like it'd have to be a pretty big frame for this now, the way it's going up there.
Yeah.
But maybe you wouldn't have to go all the way to the top, and it wouldn't make too much difference if the top got nipped out. You could protect the trunk, keep bark from busting, see?
Yeah.
And just make your frame and put that plastic up there. Kind of a tent around it.
Yeah.
And protect it.
And then?
Mrs. likes them. And they really smell, you know. You can pick them, put them in the house. They stank the whole darn house up.
Yeah. Well, now, next spring, then, what do? Leave the frame up?
No, take it down after cold weather's gone.
Yeah. Jim, you've used that plastic.
Yeah.
I really...
Well, you got to have something to frame to hold it up there. Get you something like about 1x2s or something like that to tag it on.
Yeah.
Hold it up there.
You know,
put a frame up around this here on three sides, see? On that side over there and this and over there and leave this open.
Yeah.
And put some tin up there on it to protect it.
Yeah.
I got some little old... down here. I don't know if they get quite enough sunlight where they're at, but I got quite a few persimmons off of no one or two along.
They're bandits. I've seen them. Mm-hmm. Some like them.
That one there had a couple on it, but this one's got three or four on it yet, I think.
Yeah. Now, they'll be good right up to the frost, won't they?
Yeah, that one is right now.
Don't pull it off, or are you going to take it in?
Take it in. It's ripe.
I didn't think they're that hard coming off.
Yeah, pretty hard.
Well, you can feel them and just tell when they're ready, can't you? And it's still hard.
They get soft when they're ripe.
Mm-hmm. And you go right on down to the highway.
Yeah. 350 or 60 feet on the highway there. Yeah. See this line here with the woods there, the way it runs down here. About from there down that way.
Well. You know, it's nice to have that sort of protection.
Yeah.
As long as you've got that, you
Won't be too close to the highway yourself.
No. Don't bother too much with the noise or nothing else.
Yeah.
I'd be glad to
have that. That first crop is bigger.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Oh, that's huge. I haven't seen any of them big.
I've got a few bananas this time. They're kind of late. But, just that and all that done broke down with a hank on it, ain't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a couple more now, I think. It's
now, if you don't get them, the possums will get them.
Yeah. You, but you got too many on now this year. They, some of them are late. I don't think they'll get there.
You mean you last year you really had a banana crop?
Yeah. See, there's a bunch here. I don't think they'll get there. They're too late.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's a nice clump.
Yeah. These here tried to take over here, and I dug up about half of them. I just throwed them over the wall down there.
Yeah.
And the darn thing lived down there.
Now, that's what a fellow ought to grow over.
Yeah.
That's the end of the visit with Mr. Gilbert on my rounds on Thursday, the 3rd of October, 1968. That's the end of my visit with Mr. Gilbert on the Thursday, the 3rd of October, 1968. He just took me on a little tour of his backyard where his persimmons and his second crop of figs. And that's the end of this tape, my rounds. I visit Mr. Gilbert on Thursday, the 3rd of October, 1968. Now, this is Channel 2 Right. This is Channel 2 Right around 190 on the Sony dial. This is Channel 2 Right. Now, this is Mr. Morganson on a later visit on Election Day. Just before the votes began to be counted on Tuesday, the 5th of November, 1968, he had been gone for a week or two to visit it with his brother, who's sick up in Illinois, Indiana. And I had been tied down for a week. After he got back, I couldn't check in with him. I just made an effort to catch him, and we talked for 10 or 15 minutes. I wanted to see his frame of mind after he got back from that trip, where he certainly talked about his Mr. Wallace, George Wallace. And now that it looked like Mr. Wallace wouldn't do very well on the election. All of
a slip of paper, he's only voted. And then when he paid his income tax, take that $25 off.
Yeah.
See? That'd make them vote.
Yes,
sir. Well, I don't know this shit we've got done that.
I don't think it would.
It's going to happen. Nixon and Humphrey and neither one's going to get a majority.
Yeah.
Now what's going to happen?
Yeah.
They say it'd be thrown at the House of Representatives. I don't ever believe that.
Yeah.
Let me show you something. If you and Buck Weaver and I were running for president, and you and Buck was top man, but neither one of you had a majority, and I could say, now, I come to you and I'd say, now, look here, man, I'll get my electoral vote to go for you and make you president. If you give me a contract guaranteeing that you'll back up what you've been saying in your speeches.
Yes.
Nixon Wallace made the same speeches, practically.
Yes.
You know what Nixon do if Wallace tell him that? Now, he said he ain't gonna make no deal with him, but you know what Nixon do if Wallace tell him that? That's all between him and the presidency.
Yeah.
Either one of them would take it so quick to make your head swim. Well, you know they would.
Yeah.
Shoot.
What's
going on?
Say something that they haven't been able to say.
That's right. And I'm 65 years old. It's the first time in my life that I have ever really had a choice to vote on what I wanted. Because always before, the Democrats, I was born and raised a Democrat, and the Democrats would get up there and is always kicking the South about something and trying to out-promise the Republicans on some minority group to get their vote.
Yeah.
And always hollering ever since I can remember, well, we get the nigger vote, we have it made. We get the nigger vote, we have it made. They have always thought that the nigger vote was a bounce of power.
Yeah.
And I've always said that the reason that they've done that is because Democrats the people didn't get together on one side.
Yeah.
Anytime, let me tell you something. time these people get together that want to, the working class of people and the little businessmen,
yeah,
they can run this country. All they got to do is just get together behind one man.
Yes, sir. If they could just get together, you know, that would be something.
You know, this is the first time that now they didn't listen to Wallace much up in the Northeast, but in the central and western states they did. This is the first time that they've ever listened to a southern man.
Yeah.
This is the first time, and they did up there this time. Although they may not vote for him, but they damn sure wouldn't listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
Said he had the most enthusiastic welcome in Chicago the other day of any candidate that's ever been there.
Yeah.
Right in the Cow Palace.
Yeah.
In the palace where,
yeah,
where Humphrey had so much trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what we need is a protest vote to protest stuff we don't like. And that's the way it should be done. We could get out in the streets and burn up some buildings and tear up some things. We could go burn up Johnson's ranch, maybe, burn up his house and all that kind of stuff. But that ain't the right thing to do. We're doing it right here. Go vote.
Mm-hmm. If you've got a chance to vote.
Yeah, if you got something to vote,
vote for.
That's right. And we never had it before. I'm going to write Kirk a letter when this is over, and I'm going to tell him I was for George Wallace, and tell him I want to tell him why. And I'm going to tell him I'm 65 years old, and all my life the Republicans and Democrats have gotten up there and tried to out-promise some minority group somewhere.
Yeah.
And I never had a choice, and I've always, since I've been old enough to remember, to hold my nose and go vote for the Democrats,
yeah,
until Goldwater ran. And then I thought that was sort of a choice.
Yeah.
I voted for Goldwater. Of course, he didn't get nowhere either. But you know why he didn't go nowhere? Listen, the Democrats got more people on the payroll than Republicans got registered.
Yeah.
Do you know that?
Yeah.
Think of that.
Yeah.
No wonder they can win.
Mr. Morrison, how long have you been working in politics?
Oh,
I mean, actually, you know, taking an interest in it like this.
Ever since I was 12 years old.
Well, I figured you talked like, you know, you had.
When I was 12 years old, I was hauling the polls to vote. And stealing votes any way I could. I brought up that way for the Democrats.
Yeah.
I'm a Democrat.
Yeah.
They're not Democrats. They're Communists.
Yeah.
That bunch of Washington.
Yeah.
They're not Democrats.
Yeah.
Shoot. If my old granddaddy knew that some little country like North Korea had wrapped one of my ships on the high seas, if it was on the high seas, if he'd have known that they grabbed one of our ships on the high seas, why, he'd have been over his
boat.
He come up on Teddy Roosevelt's day when somebody stepped on his toe, he asked to get off, and didn't get off and knock him off.
That's the truth.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
That's the way he believed in doing it.
Yes, sir. Where was you brought up?
Kentucky.
What part?
Right in the central part, Danville, Boyle County.
Yeah.
I lived in Boyle and Casey County.
Yeah.
And then when I grew up, I moved over to Lebanon. I lived there about 10 years, and I moved from there to Taylor County, Campbellsville.
Yeah.
I stayed there 10 years, and I came to Canada.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, up there, we were right smart far apart, but from down here, you see, I brought up there, right there on the Kentucky line, down there between Fulton and Union City.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's my old country down there.
Well, you wouldn't, let's see, how far are you from Paducah?
It was some little ways.
That's where George Myers down here was raised.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he was raised in Paducah.
Is that right? Oh, well, there's no distance, really, 50, 100
miles. That's
what
I was thinking,
like 50
that. And 75
miles, something like that. Yeah, yeah. Oh, and let me tell you, I had some good signs on you, talking along on your tip.
Oh, yeah, good signs. I didn't find nobody that was against Wallace.
Yeah.
Any service station I stopped in, I didn't have a sign on my card or nothing. And I'd go in, I'd say, well, how's the election going? Oh, hell, we all for Wallace here.
Yeah.
He's the only man running. He's the man that thinks like we do. He's for the working man.
Yeah.
And I went that way, clear on to Indiana. I stopped in Louisville. I stopped all over Kentucky and all up in Indiana. And I got a little paper from Kentucky that they took a straw vote around five or six counties there in the central part of the state. And Wallace had 63%, Nixon 28%, and Hubert Humphrey 9%.
Yeah. How long have you been down here?
20 years.
Whereabouts have you? You haven't been here all that
time. No, I've been here since 54.
Yeah, yeah.
I was down Brazen.
Yeah, yeah. I come down here in 57.
I came in 48.
Yeah.
It's 60, 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I tell you. Let me tell you, Mr. Morrison, I'm thinking about you every time I hear that newscast. The last few weeks, or you know, since I was over here,
mm-hmm.
that's been the worst with the way these networks pick up Wallace.
You know what they're doing up here. It's just as plain as you can see. They're just as pro-Humphrey as they can be.
Oh, they are.
They run Humphrey on there for 5 or 6 minutes every night on the news. They run Nixon for a couple of minutes, and they say, well, George Wallace said so-and-so.
Well, they don't even say that, hardly. Well, they do say that.
Well,
but,
that's about what to say.
But mostly they show a bunch of hecklers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I believe that made him vote, because people think, well, now there's that man there trying to speak, and we don't, and he can't even speak in this country. It don't reflect on Wallace. It reflects on them, on the government.
I don't know. It looks to me like now you see, I listen to these networks. They've got good programs, all like that. But you know, that whole Chicago convention was rigged.
Why, sure.
They rigged that just as strong as they
those
could.
Those politicians rigged it, and if they'd let it alone, McCarthy would have carried it, because he'd look. Let me tell you something. Anytime you go to all over the country and go to the people, and the people elect a man, and Hubert Humphrey didn't have guts enough to stick his nose in a single primary. And then they go there to the convention and say, well, we're going for Humphrey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's what they've done.
I know. He's, I don't know a thing about the election, I see. I haven't been into it. But it seems to me like Humphrey has stuck his nose into a lot of things.
And they, I'll tell you another thing they're doing, too. McCarthy and all that bunch up there in New England state that was so bitterly opposed to Humphrey at the convention out there and talked about Daley, what Daley done.
Yeah.
Of course, Daley was doing all that for Humphrey, you know.
Yeah.
And then Humphrey got up and bemeaned Daley for doing it and said he's going to have an call for an investigation of it. And by George, all that bunch has turned around now, walked right up to the trough and started drinking with him.
Yes, sir. Now, you tell me that. Okay. You tell me, yes, sir.
Yeah. And all this bumming halt wasn't done for a thing in the world but to give Hubert Humphrey votes.
Yeah.
Johnson's playing politics with them boys' lives over there.
Did you see Bill Mauldin's picture the other night?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll bring that over and he'll show that to you.
This boy, last night, Nixon said that he understood that there's convoy after convoy coming down that Ho Chi Minh Trail since it stopped the bombing.
Yeah.
And Humphrey said it was a lie.
Yeah.
Last night, Humphrey said it was a lie.
Yeah.
And this morning on the news, the guy from Vietnam did say it was.
Said
it was coming.
Yeah.
I hope 100 million people saw that on the news this morning. It wasn't in politics, you know.
No.
That was that man. That's that reporter from Vietnam just talking.
Yeah.
But Humphrey said last night was a lie.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe Hubert Humphrey on a stack of Bibles as high as you can chew a cannon.
I don't know. He's been in politics long, Mr. Morrison. I don't know. He's on the side of spending money always.
And he's a giving away. Listen, I've got a piece that I cut out of paper. I haven't got it here now, but I want to show it to you one day, let you read it. A nigger wrote it in Hamilton, Ohio. He's editor of a nigger newspaper, nigger-owned newspaper, and he wrote it. And of all the people, he said that this federal government should be something done with them for permitting the TV stations take up 9 hours of prime time for a man who not only offered but insisted on people giving the North Vietnamese their blood while we was at war with them. Well, you know who that was. That's Robert Kennedy. They took up that 9 hours prime time at his funeral, you know, over his funeral scene.
Yeah.
And oh, they were, he was just low-grading them. And he said that there was people on relief had been on for the third generation.
Yeah.
And said that he just couldn't understand it, that the government had promoted and said that they were the third generation, most of them were illegitimate.
Yeah. Or they can do better, you see, if their husband don't live with them, you see.
Yeah, they can make more money.
They can make more money.
Well, we've got news right here that, no, I ain't got no husband. No, I'm a widow. I ain't got no husband.
Yeah.
And a lot of times he's right in the other room when the welfare woman's there. Why don't they go around and ask, Buck Weaver? Now, do you know so-and-so? Yeah. Well, how many is her family? Well, so many. They could just go around to the neighbors and check on them. These welfare people are just as stupid as oxes. They go in and just take their word for it. I know a place down here in Ocala, fella, tell me about it. It's on a corner like this. Old woman lived over here and the daughter lived over on this road. It's on the crossroad, see. And they had 4 or 5 children. Old woman's claimed that her daughter run off and left them on her and she had to keep them. Well, she'd have them over here, the welfare woman would be there, and as soon as she'd leave, they'd change clothes right quick and go across the field over here and go to the other place. And be over there and both of them drawing money on them. And a fella found out about it, a white man found out about it. He told me this. And he went down to the welfare office in Ocala and told him about it. And the man says, we wish you'd keep your goddamn mouth out of our business. Said, we know how to tend to it and you keep your mouth out of it. Well, he said, he just come on out. I said, well, I'll tell you what if you'll do. If you get me the name of the man in the welfare office that told you that, and the name of the niggers, the old woman and the daughter, and the number of children that they actually got, I won't write to the governor. I'll take it and go up there and tell him. And he said, well, I said, I ain't going to bother with them more. I said, I'd get in trouble with them some way. He said, the government would be on me, all over me. He said, I ain't going to bother with them no more.
Yeah, the government can get you on all sides.
Yeah, look at these Republicans that wouldn't go along with something Johnson wanted up there a while back, and they're investigating their income tax.
Yeah.
Jumped on not only the senator, but jumped on the Internal Revenue, jumped on all of his help.
Yeah.
You know what I'd do if I was senator up there?
Do you?
I'd pass some laws.
You get the Gainesville Sun?
No, I don't think it. It's got too communistic for me.
Well, you got the Bill Morton's on their tour page.
Yeah, I know.
I'll bet you on, what do you get?
I get the Tenth Tribune.
I bet you it's in there.
He is sometimes.
You look at yesterday's paper, or the day before. I think it's yesterday's paper. Yeah. That is extraordinary. If it's not, I'll bring it by. I want you to see that picture of Johnson. I want you to see it here, Bill Morton. Picture Johnson. Mr. Morton, I just want to check in with you.
Okay.
What they going to do, what we going to do now after the election, is Wallace going to keep quiet a while? Is he going to keep on?
Oh yeah, he's got an independent party going. He's going to be on the party. He's got this third party going, and unless he can work out a deal with them and they straighten out and give us some recognition and come our way some, why, he'd be right back running again.
I don't see any signs that they want to change.
No, they don't seem to want to.
It looks to me like right the last few weeks, Humphrey has been talking like a new dealer, just like he always was.
Yeah, he has, and the people have seem to flock with him. Unless these pollsters are lying, I'm inclined to believe they're lying, just to get him votes. You know, there's millions of people in this country that would rather go vote for him if they hated him than to vote for a loser.
Yeah.
I'm not that way. If I go down here and vote, I don't give a damn. If you'd run for office and I liked you and I thought you was a man, and everybody down there stood and said, well, I'm not going to vote for him. I'm not going to vote for him. I'd walk up and I'd stack your name down there. I'd say, by gosh, I am. That's the way I believe. That's the way I'm going to do it. I'm just that contrary.
I voted for Nixon. I didn't think Humphrey would get it. I thought maybe Nixon could.
Well, I voted for Wallace. I'll tell you why I voted for Wallace.
I didn't vote for Wallace.
I'll tell you why I voted for Wallace. Nixon, 8 years ago, Nixon was just like Kennedy.
Yeah.
They're both trying to out-promise these damn minority groups.
Yeah.
But you know what? Nixon's changed this time.
Yeah.
You hear Nixon talking, you think it's George Wallace.
Yeah.
Well, he thinks George Wallace is right, and he's a-talking like George Wallace.
Yeah.
And he's saying the same thing George Wallace is. Well, if George Wallace can keep either one of them from getting the majority, then he's going to go to Nixon and say, now, look here now. If you give me a contract in writing that you will back up what you've been saying,
yes,
I'll ask my electoral vote to go to you, and it won't go to the House. It'll never go to the House. I'll just ask my electoral votes to go to you. And I'd put Nixon in. Well, now, who's going to turn the presidency down when they can get that?
Yeah.
You don't have to give George Wallace a thing. Just sign him a contract.
Yeah.
That he'll back up what he's been saying.
Because
he's been saying the same things that Wallace has. I've been through the same thing.
Yeah. Now, this is the end of the short tape with Mr. Morganson on election day, before the evening news and before the election returns started coming in, on Channel 2 Right around 4:25. Channel 2 Right, 4:25, the end of this short tape with Mr. Morganson, just checking in with him, see what he found out on his trip to Indiana or Illinois, and what he thought the prospects were now that Mr. Wallace's prospects seem a little dim. Now, this is back to Saturday, the 9th of November, 1968, at the store late when I went over to pay Fred for the snap corn that he ground for me. And Mr. Gallagher came in, and he lit off in talk, and one little thing went right to another until he had to go on home. And I just thought to myself, Bud, if I could just go on home with you, we really would have some talk. And this is around 4:30, Channel 2 Right, Channel 2 Right, beginning of a very short tape of Mr. Gallagher. Mr. Gallagher, a very short tape of Mr. Gallagher at the store late Saturday, the 9th of November, 1968.
I got to get a gauge. I don't have one. I had one and got tracked and went home.
That tin can is good as anything.
And measure it, I guess.
Sure.
That's right. Wash tub is just as good.
Yes,
then.
Yes, it's a good measure.
Yeah.
I saved that other thing.
You know,
other thing. Shea boys got to where they get aching and poked up it. Believe it or not, that's the truth. I know that's what did it. Our garage, the roof faces the kitchen, you see, and it's V-crimp. And I've seen them come up there and just grab a hold of it, you know, and stand there with their mouth and poke them. Acorns up in that crimp, you know?
Wow,
that's the honest truth. And I know they're the very bullies that put those acorns in my water gauge. I was down here at Bill's a while back and asked them if they had any, and they said no, they didn't have any then. I haven't thought to ask them about it anymore. I kind of like to have one around.
It's hard to buy them. There's no place to buy them. Somebody has to give them to you.
That's right. Seminole Seed Stores gave us two here several years ago, and they have both gotten broke. That's been 10, 12 years ago. We don't have any at all. I think we're going to get some more, to tell you the truth about it.
It said so. It said this weekend.
Yeah.
They just keep on.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Well, now,
by the way, did they play?
I'll have to ask Fred about that. He'll
how'd it come out, Mr. Wood?
Mr. Garrett, go ahead. Good, I'm ashamed to say.
Well, I gather from that then that Florida must have lost.
Florida got beat worse than heaven the last.
How bad?
51-0.
You don't mean that.
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, there was a little write-up in the paper a day or two ago. You might have noticed it. Pertaining to Mr. Graves' resignation. That might bring it back. I hope not.
It won't be that much longer.
You remember Bob Woodruff? He stood it so long and finally went to Tennessee, didn't it? Somewhere up in that?
He's athletic director up there.
Same. One of those Tennessee colleges. Yeah. I don't remember which one. Of course, you can't win them all. You know that. That's the truth about it. But 51
wins. I played
football but one game in my life. In fact, Dennis, you got to get on up there in school to be able to play. Well, I'll be honest with you, I wouldn't swear that I completed the fifth grade back there in Mississippi when I came along. School was school, I'm telling you the truth. We did well to get beans. We couldn't even get textbooks, you might say. You'd go and buy one book and maybe get a speller and an arithmetic all under the same binding. And you buy another, maybe you'd get a geography and a reader. I guess they were doing the best they could, but what I started to say, I didn't even know what football was, and I went into World War I, got up there at Port Oglethorpe, Georgia, and the Fast Norton's up there for us to play football. And, brother, I went out there on the field one day, and it was so cold you could just break blazes, you know. And I was pretty salt. I'd come right out of an office and store job, something like this, combination job. I was pretty salt. And I'm telling you the truth, some of those guys turned me every way but loose. I started figuring right then to get by it, and that wound my football playing up. But I got into something that was just a little bit worse. Well, the next thing that come up, we had the box.
Oh.
And old big sergeant by the name of Dave Tate from up there in Arkansas, his shoulders was that wide. He was instructor. Got out there one cold Saturday morning, you know, and he said, "Gary, you're in Quintero." He was a little Mexican and weighed about 140 pounds, and I weighed at least 165. And we went at it, and me and him, mostly him. And he was turning me every way but loose, head. And they began to holler around there, "Look at that big stiff, look at him, look at him." Well, I didn't like that too much, and he was about to beat my ears off on that cold morning.
Right.
And I just kind of stepped back and let him come into me, you know. And so help me, I managed to get him right upside the ear there. And his head hit just about like that last basket over there. And I'll never forget it as long as I live what the boy said when he got up. He raised his hands up. He says, "Sergeant, let Garrigan box somebody his size." He says, "He's too heavy for him." Oh, there was a little bugler there by the name of Georgie Alexander. He was from up here about Atlanta. And he was hard. He'd been in the Army a long time. So he was my next partner. And brother, if I ever told it in my life, that boy liked to beat me to death. He couldn't hit too hard because he was too small. But he liked to have just ground my ears off completely. And that wound up my box. And that wound it up. Something else I want to tell you about that little boy, too. No, he wasn't one with another little like that. Named Georgie Alexander. He was from Atlanta also. His daddy was on the police force over there. And we went over the hill on the 12th of August, which was on a Saturday morning. And he wasn't over there. Top, I don't suppose, 3 minutes for it. I believe he must have almost got a direct hit on it. Well, I find a fish. I got to go back and see if she got it cooked.
Well, that's something to look forward to, Mr. Gary.
Yeah, we haven't had any in a pretty good while, and Ben brought us a few up there last night. He brings us some every once in a while.
Uh-huh.
I really enjoy them, tell you the truth.
That's right, Smart Room.
Down here, the new preacher tomorrow.
Oh!
The ball landed in the lake out there on the field at about 30 feet across the darn thing up there.
Oh, wonder what they did. Did they try to circuit them lakes when they were running?
Fell down on it in the lake, I think.
That's
right. One time, that thing reminded me of Jared of him. Yes, a colored football team playing another colored football team. He had a boy on one of the teams. His name was Leroy, and he was supposed to be real good. Well, this team they were playing was a big one, boys, as a tough one. Coach out there, he told him, he said, "Now, get the ball." I said, "Give the ball to Leroy. He'll carry it through." Made several plays and got racked up pretty bad there. Leroy wasn't carrying the ball. He called one of the boys out there and told him, said, "You go back in there and tell him I said to give the ball to Leroy. Let him carry the ball." Yeah, but Leroy still didn't carry it. He called him back out and said, "Why in the world don't you all give the ball to Leroy?" He said, "Leroy said he don't want the son of a bitch." Too much pressure on Leroy.
I can understand that all right. I can picture that. Well, that's it. A man like Fred, I don't see sometimes how he lives with himself. He's got so many old fool stories in his mind. It's the end of that little tape, Mr. Garriga. He going home to eat fish. He couldn't linger either. This is around 575 on this channel 2 right. Channel 2 right, around 575, between 75 and 80, 575 and 80. This is Saturday, the 9th of November, 1968. Saturday, the 9th of November, 1968. The end of this short tape with Mr. Garriga and Fred at the store. Is that? And if it is, then it's impossible to read Twain, because that's his whole mode of operating. That's the heart of Twain. You see, without some insight like this, all we do is read it as funny and exaggerated. And what this is, you see, it's not exaggeration. He has an idea. He has something moves him, you see. And this spirit he has fills his sails. This spirit that he has, this notion that he has, fills his sails, you see, and puts life into that old tall manor that he grew up with. But without knowing Emerson, you see, he did that in that marvelous, fine Emersonian manner. He just worked into it. It was, I don't know what it was. It was just a spark. Somehow that spark stayed alive. I couldn't explain in the first place how he'd ever climb atop of the flying coach and dangle our legs over the side and shout occasionally at the frantic mules merely to see them lay their ears back and scamper faster and tie our hats down to keep our hair from blowing away, and level an outlook over the worldwide carpet around us for things new and strange to gaze at. Now, how he would ever do that? How he would ever do that? That seems to be just the heart of the matter. And these concrete things, maybe, that he saw and, as he said, got better acquainted with. I got well acquainted with his race afterwards and can speak with confidence. Those strange objects must have filled his sails too. The objects themselves. As Whitman says, those objects that bring from diffusion my thoughts, which call from diffusion my thoughts, those objects. And it's the objects rather than the abstractions, you see. And here it is, here he is, looking at those marvelous fine objects.
By and large, opposed to the positions that the academic community takes.
Well, I'm talking here about right after the war.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about time today.
No, I know you
time,
say, because you want to say that
decade.
You survived.
Yes, I mean, that should be clear. I'm talking... maybe some of the premises that went into this. Time was very early, before many Americans, anti-Nazi, anti-fascist, and very early saw the inevitability of World War II, and in effect more or less accepted its inevitability and was very anti-isolationist. And Time and Harry Luce in those days took great steps to try and convince the country to, and convince the president at the time to give up isolationism and to recognize the fact. I think in that instance, certainly the academic community was entirely with Time. Time very quickly after World War II saw that the fascist enemy having been beaten, that the real enemy then was communism. And I don't need to tell you that very many people, including very many in the academic community, did not believe that immediately. And a certain amount of animus towards Time developed at that time.
But do you think that this is behind you?
Oh, I think very much so.
It is about Time magazine that makes it so significant a talking point among so many people, and to attempt to understand why it is that people feel so strongly about it. Now, I don't think it's sufficient to say that, after all, it's merely because it expresses strong opinions. Other people express strong opinions, too. I think, rather, it would be a combination of that plus hauteur, plus impenitence, plus a very widespread conviction that Time magazine, once a magazine is off the stands, cares nothing at all about history having been left awry after that particular journalistic encounter. That is to say, a lot of people say that what they resent most about Time magazine is its stubborn refusal to own up to inaccuracies, to attempt to atone for them. Don't you think that this is so?
No, I don't. We have errors, but I'd say on the whole we have a fewer percentage of errors than anybody else who attempts to say as much and to make as many judgments as we do. What we do, the way in which we're different from most other publications, is that when we make an error, we hear about it. And most people love to catch Time in an error. Also, very often, especially if the protagonist of a story doesn't like the story, and can't really complain about that, but if he can find that we got his daughter's age wrong, then he can say, "Why, didn't even get my daughter's age right."
Mm-hmm.
And that, he thinks that destroys the validity of the whole story. Of course it doesn't, but he'll keep telling you that.
Well, I think what you have said in effect is that a lot of people complain unreasonably, and I think that's true. But there's something here about Time magazine that people feel rather ferociously about, and I think it's important to explore, A, because of Time's conceded influence, and B, because a Time magazine sets a certain mode. It has a certain paradigmatic effect on the culture of journalism. You get people like Randolph Churchill writing to Mrs. Lewis and saying, writing to Mr. Lewis, saying, why do you allow your papers to falsify the true and intrude into the private lives of other people? Why, when one of your papers makes a mistake and your readers seek to correct it, do you falsify and suppress the truth? Or you have an entire issue of a magazine that's devoted to animadversions on Time.
You're certainly not going to exhibit here a magazine that was as something significant.
No,
was,
go ahead.
What?
Go ahead, but watch it. What did you say? Because I think you're about to commit an evasion. Because I hate that magazine probably worse than you do.
I'm not going to commit an evasion. I'm just going to remind you, who doesn't have to be reminded, that he's been twice convicted.
Yeah, he's a convicted pornographer and libel.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. This is the kind of thing that's going to annoy a lot of people. You're saying this because, as a matter of fact, I was invited to contribute to this issue of Fact Magazine. The letter came to me the day after I had written a scathing letter to the head of your letters department. I suspect she doesn't really exist, but she's an institution. I think her name is Mary Louise Purdy.
Mary Lois.
Mary Lois Purdy. Oh, she does exist.
Oh, very much so.
She's
married.
And you had committed a dreadful distortion on me, and in the first place, it took 5 weeks for her to answer my letter.
How often do you answer? How fast do you answer all the complaints you get for National Review?
Faster.
You don't get very many of them.
Yes,
all your readers are committed, and they don't have any quarrel with you.
No, and you see, you're terribly efficient. Everybody knows that you can produce a cover story on 2.5 hours' notice. So for you to say correct distortions on 5 weeks' notice and then not correct them at all, it's the kind of thing that gets people very sore. Now, wait a minute.
Who says it's a distortion? You say it's a distortion.
It was a distortion.
We take great care with every letter that comes in. We go over all the files right away. And you can sit here and say it was a distortion, but perhaps it wasn't. Why should we even recognize it?
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. We'll not constitute a jury here. And I hate to give something that involves me, but this is a very simple one and a more recent one.
I get quoted
in Time magazine. I get quoted in the New York Times as saying, quotes, Professor Oakeshott, I'm lecturing at the New School. I say, Professor Oakeshott has said that perhaps the only economic function for the state is to maintain a stable currency. The New York Times reports it as saying, Buckley quoted Professor Oakeshott as saying, the only function of the state, not even, see, there goes economics, the only function of the state is to maintain a stable currency. Time magazine picks it up from the New York Times, says, Buckley said, and here goes Oakeshott. Buckley says that the only function of the state is to maintain a stable currency. I write to Time magazine and say, look, I don't want to appear as a horse's ass, because as anybody would be who said this was the only function of the state, would you please mind terribly saying, A, that I was quoting Oakeshott, and then he said, economic function, silence, or whatever it is. And then long, very sweet letter, saying, that's very interesting, and they're very glad to know about the
like
functions of the
letters.
State.
You'd rather have an angry letter? I mean, after all, Mary Lois Purdy is a lady.
Now, this issue of VAC magazine is not the opinions of Ginsberg about your magazine. It's the opinions of Bertrand Russell.
Oh, yes, but have you read them?
Ingersoll.
Have you read them?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, these a lot of people are sorehead.
I mean,
P.G. Wodehouse is not a sorehead.
They're not even sorehead. I mean, here's Tallulah Bankhead saying, my goodness, how can you do this? One week you say, Tennessee Williams is a very bad playwright. All he does is write plays about homosexuality and also other indecencies and so forth. And 3 months later, think of it, just 3 months later, you call him the greatest living American playwright. How can you commit an error like that? What nonsense is that?
That's rather interesting.
One, that
you should advise your readers to pay no attention to him. And to consign
Gleichschaldung about Tennessee Williams?
What's that?
You want Gleichschaldung about Tennessee Williams?
No.
One was a review of a very bad Tennessee Williams movie by a movie critic, and one was a paragraph in the cover story by a theater critic about Tennessee Williams. And both were true. But what's so bad about that?
Wait a minute. Your record on Tennessee Williams is at least interesting because each time you spoke apodictically about the man and his art, on Monday you would say the guy is a lesser talent.
You want us to have
on
a
Tuesday
opinion
you would
about
say
Tennessee Williams? You want the line set? The managing editor says, this is our view of Tennessee Williams, all please, sir? I mean, come on.
No. And I agree that you very likely had a different reviewer who was squared off differently to Tennessee Williams, as you and I might.
And
seeing
Tennessee
different
Williams
plays.
Wrote different plays.
No, but you see, don't you see?
And different
but
movies.
It is characteristic of time never to allow a criticism of a particular event to carry the critical judgment. You insist rather on generalizing and exactly situating Tennessee Williams in modern culture sort of for all time. You feel this is a Mount Rushmore expedition with it every time. So if it comes out and contradicts your own judgment a month or two later, this is distracting.
Well, I don't know why it should be distracting to you. It isn't to most of our readers. I mean, we're only a weekly magazine, after all, and we certainly can't change our opinion in the meantime.
Suppose in January you say, Senator Jones is an evil man and ought not to be trusted under any circumstances.
Yeah.
And suppose in February you say, Senator Jones should receive the Nobel Prize.
Well, I think that would be heinous, and I don't think the Time has ever done that. No. And I don't think you can't get by with insinuating that. We've never done anything like that, no. I will grant you this, that years ago, in the early days of Time used to be very, I think the word was snippy in those days, with the people who wrote letters. And this was a very young and a very brash magazine, and this was when Luce and Haddon, and I think Haddon did this more than Luce, and, or sort of set the pattern, and the phrase for it is that there was an answer to a letter, let reader good kind mind his manners. This was an upsetting a reader. I think there really was a good kind, setting him down, telling him he didn't know a damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are, not so much today, but in those days, were afraid to write letters to Time because of that whiplash answer that they might get.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this, as far as public relations is concerned, this might not have been a very good idea. I do want to say, though, that all letters, especially from distinguished citizens, mm-hmm. get serious consideration. And
in fact, you meditate over them for 5 weeks.
Well, maybe longer sometimes. I mean, you're always in trouble. You see, when you start quoting the New York Times, you sometimes get into trouble.
Sure. No. Please, don't misunderstand me. I'm not.
I mean, this was certainly not. I mean, this was.
I'm not suggesting this was a
certainly
fraud.
Not the the worst thing that ever happened to you to be misquoted in this context.
No. This is simply the easiest thing to regurgitate at this point of view. The other was rather involved.
You thought, you had time here, so let's make the most of it.
No, as a matter of fact, all I needed to round the symmetry of the entire performance was a letter from Oakshott, published in Time Magazine, saying, who is this horse's ass Buckley who's saying these odd things about the state? That would have made it sort of poetic, don't you think?
Why didn't you get him to write it?
I damn near did. But the it is true that there is a suggestion of impenitence which a lot of people relate to something that I happen to have no objections to, which is conviction.
No, certainly.
For instance, Mrs. Luce once told me that she believes that a lot of the opposition to Time Magazine has to do with its pro-Christian bias, by which she obviously didn't mean anything stupid like anti-Mohammedism or anti-Semitism or anything like that, but why she meant her husband was known as a practitioner of Christianity, he sometimes considered Time Magazine as a positive evangelistic organ, to be sure one that accommodated itself to the necessary lifestyle of effective journalism, but that under the circumstances, a lot of people simply reacted against what they considered to be an almost dogmatic approach to the news, moralistic. Do you understand that point of view at all?
Yes, I think it's quite conceivable that some opposition to Time has been based on the fact that Time certainly looked at the world through more Christian eyes, if that's a possible way to do it, than most other journals, certainly than most other general journals, so forth, or certainly large circulation journals. On the other hand, I think that also made for a good deal of Time's acceptance. I would say the acceptance outweighed the anti-Time feeling there on that part.
That the robust sense that you have of being right on all issues tends to be perhaps at least as attractive to some people as it's unattractive to others.
No, I was talking here about Time in its and in some cases viewing the world through different, or having a religion section with which we did a great deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly some people have said, well, it's a great magazine, but why don't you drop the religion section? Well, no, we say that no religion